4 years ago, in March 2010, President Obama signed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act into law, Obamacare. State exchanges were to be up and running this January, but the actual rollout of Obamacare has been a mess, and it's likely to be a significant issue in this year's midterm elections. University of Pennsylvania professor and bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel examines the state of the American healthcare system and the Affordable Care Act in his new book called Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Grossly Inefficient, Error-Prone System. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ezekiel Emanuel back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
How do U.S. health outcomes compare with other industrialized democracies on measures of things like life expectancy, lung disease, infant mortality, and the like?
Well, on life expectancy from birth, we're way behind most of the world. Even at life expectancy at 65, so you take out the children who are born early in the United States and may not survive, or the high level of adolescent and young adult deaths that we have from violence and accidents. But even at 65, we don't perform so hotsy-totsy. We're 12th in terms of men's longevity after 65 and 16th in terms of women's. Infant mortality is another place where we have a very high rate of infant mortality compared to the rest of the world. Ours is even worse than Cuba, and it's twice the best places like Singapore and Japan.
Well, politicians often insist that the United States has the best health care in the world. Is there anywhere where the United States performs significantly better than the rest of the world?
Well, there's at least there's some plausible argument that in cancer we're doing we're top, but we're not top by stretches that dwarf the rest of the world. There are some countries like France that are equally good, and in other places there are other countries that are equally good. So cancer is the one area where it's where there's some discussion, but in almost every other metric, we're not certainly in the top five.
So how can politicians make that claim? And do Americans believe it? What do the polls reveal about what the public thinks about us, our healthcare system?
Well, I certainly think through about 2008, this was a common trope that everyone used. And then I think people began to flip. I wrote an article in JAMA that this is one of those claims that really can't be sustained.
That's the Journal of
the American Medical Association. And I think around 2008, a lot of people began criticizing the American healthcare system and sort of rejecting this notion, and politicians became more careful. On the other hand, people say, are willing to beat the chest and being nationalistic about it. But there really is no data, and you really couldn't substantiate that claim that we have the best healthcare system. Individuals can get great healthcare, and some academic centers and other hospitals are really fantastic. But the quality is very uneven across the country, and we can't guarantee the best to every citizen. And that's really the standard of the best healthcare system in the world.
And last year, JAMA published a report on the state of U.S. health, which showed that the health of Americans is mediocre compared to other countries. If we were to compare the American healthcare system to the Canadian or the French without identifying which was which, do you think anyone would pick the U.S. system?
Some people might. Again, it depends what you're looking for. But I think overall, it's very hard to defend. And almost every expert thinks that there's substantial room for improvement. And I think that's the important point.
Well, do you think anyone would pick the U.S. system even with full implementation of Obamacare?
Well, I think it's going to get a lot better, and it's already gotten a lot better. I don't think the whole rollout, contrary to your introduction, has been a disaster. The exchanges, the federal exchanges, were a problem. But there are many other parts of it that have gone remarkably well. The policies regarding hospital readmissions have gone well. Healthcare inflation has now at its lowest level since the mid-1990s, and that's partially due to the Affordable Care Act. I think we're in the midst of a transition, and there are lots of parts of the system which are responding quite well to the new incentives of the reform.
The percentage of Americans with no health insurance dropped from 17.1% to 16% in the fourth quarter of 2013. Is that a result of Obamacare? And although we are only talking about 1.1%.
I think we're beginning that turnaround, and we are beginning to see a lot more people get insurance, either through employers who are now offering, or the exchanges, or Medicaid. And I think that percentage will continue to drop over the course of the decade.
Although a little over 50% of Americans disapprove of Obamacare, what do you think that is?
I think there's been the communication strategy hasn't been the best. I think we are in the midst of a change. Anytime you're in the midst of a rapid change, people get nervous, and being nervous, they get somewhat negative. And I think that's where we're at. On the other hand, you know, we did some polling of chief executives of major health systems and pediatric hospitals, and about 70% of them said that by 2020, the American healthcare system is going to be somewhat or significantly better than it is today. So people who were involved in the healthcare system, they view this reform quite positively.
Well, how much of an impact do the controversial ad campaigns by groups like Americans for Prosperity have on influencing public opinion? I found an interesting thing from Bloomberg Business Week, which reported that disapproval of the ACA is highest among middle-income Americans who have insurance.
Which is strange, because if anything, it's going to have a positive effect for them for keeping their premiums low and improving the quality of care if they got sick and went to hospitals. I think that just shows you that it's just sort of general anxiety rather than anything specific about the reform itself. And so I don't count much on where we are. You know, I often view this like, how are we doing at 2014? It's kind of like looking at the pot on the stove and wondering, is the water boiling, and checking it every few minutes. We're changing the healthcare system in America, which is the size of the entire economy of France. You're not going to change it overnight, and it's going to take some time. And so I think the proper frame is, how is it going to be at the end of the decade for us?
My guest is Ezekiel J. Emanuel. His latest book, Reinventing American Healthcare, it's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But there, part of the problem, it seems to me, is the rollout. And there's a report from the Hill blog that, according to two sources, as early as this week, the White House will announce a new directive allowing insurers to continue offering health plans that do not meet Obamacare's minimum coverage requirements. And prolonging the Keep Your Plan fix will avoid another wave of health policy cancellations that were otherwise expected during the fall.
Yeah, I'm not a wild fan of this delay. A lot of these suboptimal plans are really bad. They give people a false sense of being insured where they would not actually pay for anything as simple as an appendicitis or if you had, God forbid, cancer. But I also understand that you want to make the transition as easy as possible for people and to minimize disruption. But at some point, people are going to have to get off these bad plans and get into something which does provide real insurance with full prevention without copays and deductibles, and really prevents you from going bankrupt if you got a serious illness.
Well, the Obama administration has to be concerned. The cancellations would have created a real problem for Democrats in the weeks before Election Day. Haven't all the stopgap measures since the rollout that try to stem unforeseen problems contributed to the negative perception of the ACA?
Well, I think that there are two things. There's no doubt that the bad rollout of the exchanges in the 2 months when it didn't really operate has led to a lot of bad perception. And I think there could have been a better communication strategy. But let's distinguish between the perceptions and the reality about the ACA, because I think most of the reality is it's actually done pretty good across a very broad spectrum other than just the exchanges. It's been good for healthcare inflation. As I mentioned, it's been good for quality of care. And more importantly, it's directing the whole system to a new place in all sorts of ways, electronic health records, trying to improve or keep people healthy rather than just treat them when they're sick. And so I think we're focusing on the communications and the rollout rather than the bigger picture of how is it improving the healthcare system.
Well, isn't it based on a plan originally devised by the Heritage Foundation, which is a very conservative think tank, and then implemented by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts? What's your sense of why Republicans have been so vehemently opposed to the ACA?
Well, as I point out in the book in Chapter 5, you can actually see a lot of the origins of the Affordable Care Act in Richard Nixon's plan. When he was a congressman, he introduced a plan that would subsidize people based on their income to buy private insurance. Sounds a lot like the ACA, and it's been reinvigorated by Republicans at various points. As you mentioned, the Heritage Foundation in the late 80s and early 90s had a plan that had an individual mandate. Well, once the Democrats embraced it, you know, the Republicans decided to run away from it. But the fact is that this is a very bipartisan, market-friendly approach, and I think that should appeal to people across the spectrum. So the opposition is less about the actual facts and seems to be more atmospheric or ideological. Anything the Democrats propose has to be wrong.
And so they're labeling it socialist.
Well, that's ridiculous. That, I mean, every time anyone wants to get rid of a health plan, they call it socialist. But this is the most market-based plan we've ever had in America to reform the system and to give everyone coverage. It's got nothing socialistic about it. If you want socialism in health care, look at the Veterans Administration. That's true socialism in health care. But the exchanges, that's private market, private insurance with subsidies to allow people to exercise their own choice in a marketplace.
Isn't Medicare socialism to some degree? And yet that's a part of the health care system that the Tea Party people are afraid is going to be tampered with.
No, I actually don't think Medicare socialism. It's the government paying doctors, but it's still private doctors, private hospitals, private drug benefits, private home health agencies. That's still a private, completely private system. Whereas in the veteran side, the government actually does own the hospitals, actually employs directly the doctors. That's more akin to England. But, you know, the veterans love the veteran system, and they don't want to change it. And the Republicans love the Veterans Administration system. Again, it's just incoherent ideology, not with a very market-oriented view. Because if you're a market-oriented person and you think the market can actually deliver better, the Affordable Care Act should be something you'd like to embrace.
One of the ongoing criticisms of the American system is that doctors and hospitals face incentives to provide more care, like lots of tests, than they do in other countries. Does the ACA do anything to address that?
Yeah. So the fee-for-service system means that people in healthcare get paid more when they do more, when they hospitalize you, when they order CAT scans, when they do more surgeries, when they give you more chemotherapy. The Affordable Care Act begins a process of trying to shift us off the fee-for-service system by paying doctors in other ways. These accountable care organizations, hospitals and doctors working together under a fixed price, or bundle payments that are being experimented with in the ACA. These are ways to shift off the fee-for-service system. If I have a criticism of what we did, I don't think we pushed hard enough on this shift off the fee-for-service payment system. I think we could have done more, but I do think it's already having an important effect. Part of what it does is also incentivize private insurance to begin experimenting with these alternative payment models.
You note that the top 1% of healthcare spenders, not the top 100% by income, account for 1/5 of what healthcare spending is in the United States. What are consumers doing to drive increases to cost?
Well, it's not. This isn't about consumers. So 10% of the population uses about 2/3 of all healthcare resources and spending. Those people are people with chronic illness, whether it's diabetes or heart disease or emphysema or cancer.
So the wealthiest 100% are not necessarily spending the most money.
No. These are people who have serious chronic illness or many chronic illnesses at once. And if we're really going to save money in the long term, what we need to do is focus on those people, identify them, focus resources on them to keep them healthy, keep them out of the hospital, make sure that a cut on a diabetic's foot doesn't develop into gangrene requiring an amputation, keep people who have heart failure on their weight and diets and exercising. That's the new focus. That's going to be the focus, as I say in the last chapter of this book, VIP care for people with chronic illness. That is going to be the key to saving money in the future.
But what about things like smoking and diet? They are worse among poor Americans. Can healthcare reform address such behavior? Would the inequality or poverty itself have to be addressed?
there's a lot we can do about diet and smoking. These are mainly public health measures. While I was in the White House, I also worked on the First Lady's Let's Move initiative, which directly addresses things like obesity. And as we've seen from the most recent report, seems to have had a beginning to have a real impact.
On children between two and five,
well, that's
nobody else.
But that's a very important segment. And we've also seen a plateauing of obesity and overweight among adults. Those are very important numbers because obese kids grow into obese adults, and if we can reverse it among children, that'll have a very long-term positive outcome. In addition...
Well, what do you do about smoking?
Well,
there are all these anti-smoking campaigns. I still see a lot of people smoking.
We recently raised the tax on smoking to $1.01, and raising the tax will have the most benefit in terms of reducing smoking rates. In addition...
So that's it? You start charging $30 a pack for cigarettes?
That's an important... I mean, higher prices definitely discourage people, and we can predict exactly how many. Second of all, the Affordable Care Act gives people free preventative care, and smoking cessation is one of those things where people don't have to pay a copay or a deductible. The third challenge on that is that employers are incentivized to provide wellness, including efforts at smoking cessation, keeping blood pressure under control, better diet, better exercise. And I think as more employers adopt those plans, they will go, they'll augment other public health measures to improve people's weight, smoking, and exercise.
Ezekiel J. Emanuel is Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book, Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Grossly Inefficient, Error-Prone System. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Ezekiel J. Emanuel, who has written a book called Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Grossly Inefficient, Error-Prone System. It's published by Public Affairs. Well, you were in the White House. You helped write this?
Yeah, I worked on the Affordable Care Act for, the 14 months, very diligently, and then afterwards trying to help implement it.
Couldn't you have made it a little simpler?
First of all, let's get clear. It's 906 pages, not 2,000 or 2,400. Second of all, it's building on an existing system, and therefore you have to craft a lot of the policies around policies or programs that already exist. 906 pages is a little less than a Stephen King novel. It's actually not that long. So I think we need to be a little more prudent in that criticism. And again, the issue isn't the length. The issue is it going to improve the healthcare system or not?
Well, before he became a senator, Barack Obama voiced support for a single-payer system. In 2008, he advocated a public option. You were an advisor to budget director Peter Orszag in 2009. Do you know why he changed his position on those things?
Well, we couldn't get a public option through. Joe Lieberman, senator from Connecticut at that time, was against the public option. And if you wanted to get enough votes to pass the bill, you had to make compromises. That's the way legislation in a democracy works. And that was a major reason for not getting the public option. And I think on the single-payer issues, you know, there's a lot of disagreement. I actually think it's better to have multiple payers because they can experiment and they can try different things and we can see which ones work. I like to have that kind of competition in an exchange format where they all have to abide by the same rules and where those rules don't permit them to exclude people. And that, I think, is going to be a much more effective way of getting a better healthcare system.
Although when we began this discussion, we talked about some of the countries that have better healthcare systems, like Canada, like France, like England, and they all are single payer.
But lots of countries have different ways of going. Look, the Netherlands has 22 competing health plans. Israel has 4 competing health plans. So there's a lot of different ways of devising it. We're not going to get rid of insurance companies in this country, and I think that let me put it this way. you weren't going to get them in one fell swoop with the Affordable Care Act. They tried something similar to that in Clinton, and we saw what happened. You couldn't get a bill passed.
Some have argued for an extension of Medicare. Isn't Medicare effectively a single-payer system?
It is effectively a single-payer system, and I'm not sure that's the wisest policy move in the country.
In a Hastings Center report, you argued against the single-payer system. You didn't believe it would work, or you just, as you said, were being pragmatic, you knew that you couldn't get it through?
I think there are both elements there. One is being pragmatic. I don't think we're going to have a single-payer system in the United States. And the second is, as I said, I think having a exchange where everyone competes with multiple players, different insurance companies, different health plans competing is a much better way than just having one government body setting the rules.
Although it's been pointed out that in some places, like New York, you have a lot of competing companies. In other places, you have practically no competition, and people are stuck with what they find on the exchange.
Well, almost in every state, you have more choices than you would with just one-payer Medicare, so that is more choice. And second of all, I think one of the things we'll find is new entrants into the market. In Massachusetts, where they have had an exchange, they've had new entrants into the market there.
Because people want to get in on the act.
Well, I think they think they can do it more efficiently. They can offer a lower price. They can offer better quality, and they're going to try. And I wouldn't be surprised also in Massachusetts if you begin to see, for example, the Partners Health System beginning to bid on the exchange and seeing a much wider range of people offering their products. And I think that's going to happen in the United States over the course of the next few years.
Well, in the past, you advocated phasing out Medicare and Medicaid and giving households a voucher to buy insurance.
Right.
Do you still support that approach?
Well, again, I think that from a practical standpoint, we're not phasing out Medicare. I think from an efficiency standpoint, it might be a more efficient system. But yeah, have to, you know, the worst possible outcome in 2009, 2010, in my opinion, was to get no health care reform. And so you do what you need to do to get a health care bill passed. If you have to jettison the public option, you jettison the public option. And I think, you know, again, the worst option in 2009, 2010 was to continue the system. It was broken. You might remember we had rescissions common. That's people who had insurance, forgot to put down that they had acne or back pain, and then when they got cancer, weren't covered. We had huge increases in the price of insurance, 39% by WellPoint just before passage of the Affordable Care Act, reminded people how outrageous that system was and that we needed real reform. You yourself pointed out the uneven, bad quality. So you do what you need to do. But I do think the Affordable Care Act is going to lead to a much better system. Did we get everything we wanted? No. But we got a lot.
Well, most Americans with health insurance have received it through their employers. You've also argued that we need to move away from employer-based coverage.
Yeah, and I think the Affordable Care Act will provide an alternative from employer-based.
So we should all join the – I should drop my employer's health care and go on the ACA?
Well, I think that the exchanges need to be need to get more years under their belt, need to improve the experience, need to get more options. But then I do think, actually, for many people, it'll be a better option. They'll have cheaper insurance. They'll have more choices. And remember – not you, but, you know, people like my daughter who buys everything online, you know, from her computers to her clothes to her shoes to her coats, you know, buying insurance online and not having the employer come between them, I think that's actually something she'd be very comfortable with. So I think in part this is a generational issue, and she doesn't expect her employer for the long term to provide her insurance. And the exchange guarantees her competition among options, her deciding which option she wants, and no exclusions because of pre-existing conditions and other shenanigans. And I think that's a very good place to be.
In defense of myself, I do buy things online, although not shoes or coats because I would like to see
try
if
them
they
on.
Fit. Yeah. I don't like the idea of having to send it back, say, send a slightly larger size. Sarah Palin and others attacked Obamacare as imposing death panels. But hasn't the U.S. effectively rationed health care for decades?
Well, we've rationed it mostly by whether you get insurance or not and whether you can afford interventions or not. I think the notion that we've had that there's death panels in the bill has been shot down. It's quite clearly
canard.
Yeah, you hear it, and actually it just shows you that old Lenin line that if you repeat a lie long enough, people believe it's true. Because latest poll I saw, which wasn't too long ago, about a third of the public still thinks there's death panels in the bill, which is a tragedy. And I do think it makes you worried about the kinds of brainwashing we can have, and that's a bad thing.
Well, Shankar Vedantam reported on NPR's Morning Edition just this morning on how people can concede facts about, say, the benefits of vaccination, but still act according to their existing beliefs or skepticism. How can misconceptions about health care reform be effectively countered then?
I think the most effective thing is proof in the pudding. Just make the system better through the ACA. Give people more choices in the exchange. And like the original skepticism about Medicare, it's going to go away when people get comfortable with it. And when people get comfortable shopping on the exchange, when people see that health care costs have come down, that the quality, fewer hospital infections, I think they're going to see, wow, this really was a good thing. But that's going to take time, and it's not going to happen immediately.
Well, we also have Paul Ryan saying that all of the Great Society reforms were a big mistake. They're not working.
Well, we know that food stamps are used by many people and keep them save them from hunger. We know that there have been many other great reforms that people aren't willing to give up, like Medicare. Maybe he would he certainly backed off of trying to get rid of those programs because they are successful and the public likes them. And we also like Head Start, which has been a very at least quality Head Start has been very, very important for this country.
If demand for health services exceeds supply in the United States, then how should limited health services be allocated? I realize not death panels, but somebody's going to have to make a decision, you and not you.
Look, we have that phenomena in certain places. Organs for transplantation. We don't have enough livers and kidneys for everyone who needs a liver and kidney. And we develop policies and rules for how to allocate those limited resources. I teach a course on rationing and look at the case of organs, and you have to develop rules about that are fair. And I think that's a small number of cases. We need to be clear. Having absolutely scarce resources, like we do in organ transplantation, is not the norm in the rest of the healthcare system. In the rest of the healthcare system, there is no need to ration care, and that's just, again, a misnomer about the Affordable Care Act or about healthcare reform in general, and I don't think it's very helpful to the discussion. We should agree there are some places where we do have to choose who gets it, like organ transplantation, but those are very rare, and that's not the regular part of the American healthcare system.
One of the most controversial and misunderstood parts of Obamacare has been the individual mandate. Why is that so important to the healthcare system?
Well, every time we've tried to have insurance that's voluntary, you can buy it, you cannot buy it, what we end up with is what's called the death spiral. People who are sick, they buy the insurance. People who are healthy, they either are told, listen, I can give you a cheaper rate on the side, or they decide, well, this is too expensive for me, I'm not going to have it. And as you have this situation where the healthy don't buy insurance and only the sick buy, the prices go up, the number of people insured goes down, and eventually the system's unstable. It's called this death spiral. It's well known. And every expert will tell you, if you want to have a stable system, you have to make it mandatory so everyone pitches in, with the recognition that everyone over time is going to use the healthcare system. Even if you're young today, first of all, you might get something like an appendicitis. My research assistant, 25-year-old, got appendicitis this year, used the healthcare system, certainly spent a lot of money. You might have an accident. And certainly as you get older and you develop diseases, whether they're cancer or heart disease or lung disease, you will certainly use the system. And this is how we all shoulder the burden when we're young, when we're old.
But that's what insurance does.
Exactly. It spreads the burden across all people. If you make it voluntary, we're going to not have it for everyone. If you make it mandatory, we can actually keep the prices down and make sure it's available for everyone when they need it.
What are the most important features of the act that you think people need to understand? And what do you think people most misunderstand?
Well, it's commonly said that 90% of this act is about expanding access. In truth, about a quarter of the bill is about expanding access, whether through Medicaid or the exchanges. But the rest of the act deals with the quality of the healthcare system to improve it, to improve prevention, to improve cost control so that we can actually save money while we're improving the quality, to enhance the workforce issues. There's many more things here than just access, and I think that's a common misperception.
You write that an important function of insurance is that it reduces barriers using healthcare services. Isn't a common complaint from consumers and doctors that insurers make coverage difficult with paperwork, denials of claims, and other hurdles?
Yes, there are other hurdles with insurance. But remember, if you didn't have insurance and you needed a $50,000 operation, that's the barrier. As I point out in the introduction to this book, a patient named Erin, who out of the blue, 48-year-old woman in Colorado, had abdominal pain. A mass was seen on a CAT scan, needed emergency surgery, turned out it was colon cancer. That whole hospitalization cost more than $70,000. Most Americans can't write that check. You know, where I mean most, 98% of Americans just couldn't write a $70,000 check. That's when you need assurance to reduce the barriers to getting health care. And that's why we have insurance, so that if an emergency happens, the unexpected, or you get a very expensive disease, you will actually be able to afford it.
Well, many getting insurance under the ACA are seeing much higher deductibles. Why is that happening?
Well, to try to keep the premium down and to have people get the appropriate care. And remember, those high deductibles do not apply to prevention, which I think is one of the insightful policies of the Affordable Care Act. We recognize we want people to get preventative services, whether it's prevention in terms of blood pressure or prevention in terms of vaccines. And so we made those no deductible, no copay. And so I think that's the right combination, where if you need to get people to do preventative services, we have no out-of-pocket expenditures, but when they're using a lot of services, they do have to pay for it.
We're running out of time, but I noted that Stephen Helmsley of United Healthcare Group received $106 million in compensation in 2009. Many insurance executives receive tens of millions of dollars in pay. How do they justify that compensation, and how does that affect what we've been talking about?
Well, you have to ask them how they justify it. I don't think $100 million in pay is justifiable for anyone, but I was raised by someone who...
I wouldn't mind it.
Well, I don't think it would be justifiable, though. There's a difference between it would be lovely if it happened to me, but it's not justifiable as a system. On the other hand, I do think we need to be a little careful. Even if we got rid of those excessive executive pay, we would not save a lot of money. We spend $3 trillion on healthcare in this country. $100 million is insignificant amount of money in that big, big healthcare system.
Let me see if I've understood the basic message of what you've been saying. We have been experiencing bumps in the road. We're going to see some more. But in time, we're going to think this is a really good system.
Absolutely. I agree with that. That's the assessment of the Affordable Care Act. By the end of the decade, it'll have transformed American healthcare for the better.
Ezekiel J. Emanuel, his book, Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Grossly Inefficient, Error-Prone System, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's my pleasure, and I really appreciate the interview.